Imagine, for a second, just walking into a tattoo parlor.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
You sit down in the chair, the artist asks what you want, and you just hand them a picture.
Right.
But it's not a picture of, a loved one or a religious symbol or like a classic anchor.
No, of course not.
No. You hand them a portrait of a disgraced, resigned, former United States president.
Yeah, it's wild.
You literally ask them to permanently ink the face of Richard Nixon directly onto your back.
It is, it's a very striking visual.
To put it mildly.
And I mean, it immediately tells you that you are not dealing with, a conventional political figure.
Exactly. And that is the exact level of ideological commitment we're unpacking today.
Which is pretty intense.
It really is. We are looking at a man who has never held a cabinet seat, never held a high government position, and honestly, never been elected to anything.
Right, no official power in that sense.
Yeah, none. Yet, for more than 50 years, starting all the way back in the Nixon administration and, culminating in the presidency of Donald Trump, he has arguably shaped the modern political landscape entirely from the shadows.
Yeah, the influence is just staggering when you look at the timeline.
So we are diving deep into a massive historical document today. Specifically, we're getting into Chapter 19 of the Trump dossier, 2015-2029.
A fascinating chapter.
Truly, we're doing this to understand the man dubbed the architect of permanent political warfare, Roger Stone.
And to really grasp how the gears of power turn in modern democracy, you absolutely need to understand his playbook.
Yeah, because I feel like that playbook challenges every single comforting assumption we have about how political power is won.
Oh, completely. I mean, we like to think of elections as this marketplace of ideas.
Right, the noble debate.
Exactly. We want to believe that the candidate with the most rational policy or the best tax plan or the most logical healthcare reform naturally just, rises to the top.
Like it's a polite, structured debate club.
A clean architectural model of democracy. But when you step into the world of a career political operative, well, that entire model just shatters.
It becomes murky really fast.
Yeah, it becomes murky, and more importantly, it becomes deeply psychological.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because a political operative, especially, in the mold of Roger Stone, they operate as a specialist in the psychology of the electorate, right?
That's exactly it. They aren't the people in the back room drafting 50-page white papers on marginal tax rates.
Thank goodness, that sounds exhausting.
Right. Their entire focus is on narrative. It's about figuring out the precise emotional levers to pull.
To make the public care passionately about their candidate.
Yes, or arguably way more important, how to make the public actively, intensely despise the opponent.
So they are dealing with the raw, absolute mechanics of getting votes.
Yeah, the unglamorous part.
And for you listening, to understand how those mechanics have evolved over the last half century, we really have to look at where this specific brand of combative politics was born.
Which takes us back a few decades.
Yeah, Roger Stone, born in the early 1950s, he built a resume that basically reads like a chronological map of the modern Republican Party.
It really does. I mean, he worked on campaigns for Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Bob Dole, and just dozens of others.
But it's not just the resume that stands out to me here. It's the brand.
The branding is arguably the most fascinating aspect of his early career.
because he actively embraces titles that, they would instantly end the career of a conventional politician.
Oh, immediately.
He embraces being called the Prince of Dirty Tricks. He loves the label Agent Provocateur. He owns the moniker Dirty Trickster,
He wears it like a badge of honor.
which is so weird. Normally, if a political opponent calls you a dirty trickster, your PR team goes into absolute overdrive.
Right, you're putting out a press release talking about your unwavering integrity.
Exactly, your deep commitment to fair play. You deny, deny, deny.
But he leans into it. He essentially wears it on a neon sign.
So why on earth would you want to be known as the Prince of Dirty Tricks?
Well, because it serves a highly effective dual psychological purpose.
Okay, lay it on me.
First, it completely neutralizes criticism through ownership.
Oh, that makes sense.
Right. Like, if an opponent tries to launch an attack by warning the public, "Watch out, this operative uses underhanded, dirty tricks," and your immediate public response is, "Yes, I absolutely do. I'm the Prince of Dirty Tricks."
You have entirely deflated their attack.
Exactly. You've stolen their ammunition. There is no scandal to uncover because you've already, confessed to the
You
premise.
can't be exposed for something you are actively bragging about on television.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And the second purpose is deterrence.
Deterrence how?
Cultivating that aura of a dark arts operative, it sends a very clear, very intimidating message to anyone thinking about going up against your candidate.
Like a warning shot.
Right. It says, I am not bound by your polite rules of engagement. I will cross lines you won't even approach.
I will do whatever it takes.
Yes. It puts opponents off balance before the debate even begins.
You know, it makes me think of professional wrestling.
Oh, that's a good comparison.
Yeah. When I look at this philosophy, the first thing that comes to mind isn't a political debate stage. It's a wrestling ring.
Walk me through that connection.
Well, in professional wrestling, the actual physical grappling is really only half the product.
Sure.
The real money, the real engagement, comes from the roles the wrestlers play. You have the face, the hero who plays by the rules, and you have the heel, the villain.
And everyone loves to hate the heel.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The heel's entire job is to be hated. They cheat when the referee turns around. They insult the local sports team to get the crowd furious. They use just pure psychological warfare.
And the crowd absolutely loses their minds.
They buy tickets just to boo the heel.
Mm.
The negative energy is highly lucrative because it drives intense engagement.
Right.
It feels like Stone looked at American politics and realized, I'm going to be the heel and I'm going to use that heat to win.
That is a remarkably accurate analogy for the methodology at play here.
It just fits so well.
It does. In wrestling terminology, generating heat, getting the crowd emotionally riled up, even if it's negative, is the ultimate goal.
Because apathy is the real enemy.
Yes. Stone realized very early on in his career that apathy is the true enemy of a political campaign. Hatred, anger, controversy, those things are just alternative forms of energy.
And if you know how to harness that energy, you can mobilize a voting base with terrifying efficiency.
He manages the spectacle.
Which brings us back to that tattoo.
Yes. The Nixon tattoo.
It isn't just a quirky piece of trivia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Having Richard Nixon permanently etched into your skin is a massive symbolic statement.
It is the ultimate declaration of his political worldview.
Break that down for us.
For someone like Stone, Nixon wasn't a failure because of the Watergate scandal. Nixon was a visionary.
A visionary, wow.
Yeah, he views him as a pioneer of exploiting cultural divisions and tapping into what was called the silent majority.
So the tattoo is like a flag.
It's a permanent badge of honor, signaling complete loyalty to a highly specific, hard-nosed, win-at-all-costs brand of political warfare.
A philosophy that views politics not as a gentleman's debate over tea, but it's a literal battle where opponents must be damaged and the media must be manipulated.
Exactly.
But, you know, you can't just be a theoretical dirty trickster.
No, you have to pay the rent.
Right. You have to make a living. You have to monetize that skill set.
Mm.
And that requires taking this combative philosophy off the campaign trail and into the private sector.
And the 1980s provided the perfect environment for that.
Let's talk about the 80s then.
The 1980s were a transformative period in Washington. You had these massive economic shifts, a rapidly changing media landscape, and the explosive rise of the modern lobbying industry.
It was a gold rush.
It was. Political consultants who knew how to navigate both the press and the halls of power were suddenly in incredibly high demand.
And during this boom, Stone founded a lobbying firm with several partners, most notably a man named Paul Manafort.
A very significant partnership.
Now, lobbying itself is standard procedure in Washington. Environmental groups lobby for clean water regulations. Agricultural corporations lobby for farming subsidies.
It's just how the system operates.
But this specific firm took a drastically different path. They specialized in representing highly controversial foreign clients.
Yeah, these weren't standard corporate accounts.
Who are we talking about here?
They represented foreign leaders and regimes facing intense international scrutiny for, well, systemic corruption and severe human rights abuses.
But wait, isn't that just standard high-level Washington lobbying? Like, doesn't everyone represent shady clients eventually?
To an extent, yes.
So why is this specific firm singled out in the historical record?
It really comes down to the degree of controversy and the sheer audacity of the client list.
They went further than others.
Much further. While lobbying is ubiquitous, the willingness to actively seek out and embrace figures that the mainstream Washington establishment found entirely toxic, that was a defining characteristic of their business model.
So they leaned into the controversy, just like he did with the Dirty Trickster label.
Exactly. They recognized that the most undefendable clients were the ones willing to pay the absolute highest premium.
It's because no one else would take the job.
Right. And precisely because those clients required a specific brand of aggressive, no-holds-barred narrative reframing.
Which makes total sense.
Ah.
I mean, if you were representing a foreign leader with a documented, horrific human rights record, you cannot sit down with a member of Congress and try to win a factual debate about human rights.
You will lose that debate every single time.
The watchdogs have the receipts. The facts are completely against you.
So you have to change the game.
Right. So how do you actually earn your lobbying fee? What is the literal tradecraft of laundering a reputation like that?
You change the subject entirely. It is a masterclass in distraction and reframing.
Give me an example of how that works.
So if the narrative is this leader violates human rights, you do not argue that point.
You ignore it.
You ignore the premise and you launch a massive counter-narrative focusing on something completely different.
Like what?
You might push op-eds into major newspapers, framing the leader as a crucial, indispensable ally against communism.
Oh, playing on Cold War fears.
Exactly. Or you might highlight their economic value to United States trade interests. You orchestrate think tank policy papers. You set up fancy junkets for sympathetic lawmakers.
Just burying the negative story under a mountain of positive, unrelated spin.
Yes, you systematically manipulate the media coverage to make the controversial leader appear as the lesser of two evils in a really complex region.
It's basically psychological warfare on a geopolitical scale.
That's a great way to put it. It requires someone who is absolutely not afraid to operate in the ethical mud.
Yeah, you need a strong stomach.
The skills required to manage a massive international scandal, deal with an incredibly hostile press corps, and spin narratives for deeply flawed individuals, those are the exact same skills honed during the Nixon campaigns.
They were essentially acting as high-priced defense attorneys in the court of public opinion.
Spot on.
And while they were perfecting those skills on the international stage in the 1980s, the foundation for a much bigger domestic project was quietly being laid back in New York City.
Yeah, the skills didn't just stay in the lobbying firm.
They found a new vessel, a New York real estate developer named Donald Trump.
The timeline of this relationship is just critical for understanding the sheer scale of the influence we're discussing today.
Because this wasn't a recent thing. The records show that Stone and Trump have known each other since the late 1970s.
We are talking about the era of disco.
Right. That means their relationship predates Trump's actual presidency by nearly 40 years.
40 years of overlapping circles.
Shared media environments and continuous conversations about power, perception, and the press. Roy Cohn was a mutual connection back then too, right?
He was, yeah. Another master of the dark arts of PR and legal maneuvering.
So this forces you to completely reevaluate the narrative of the 2016 election.
It really does. This wasn't a sudden, opportunistic partnership forged in the heat of a primary campaign.
It was a decades-long political incubation.
Exactly.
Just think about what that actually looks like in practice for you listening. Imagine having a specific friend in your orbit for 30 or 40 years.
That's a lifetime.
Every time you have a drink, every time you chat on the phone, they are in your ear. They're telling you that you are destined for the highest office.
Building that narrative.
And more importantly, they are coaching you on exactly how to play the media.
Yeah, that's the key.
If a rival politician fumbles a scandal, that friend is on the phone saying, look how weak they look.
Yeah.
Here is how you handle that. You don't apologize. You attack the reporter who asked the question.
Never back down.
Over three decades, that drip, drip, drip of philosophy is going to fundamentally shape your entire worldview.
It creates a shared ideological DNA.
That's a great phrase.
The historical documentation notes that Stone served as an advisor, a confidant, a campaign coach, and an informal political mentor.
He spent years continuously pushing Trump to run for president.
Yes, and this highlights a profound truth about how Washington operates informal networks, and deep personal mentorships are often vastly more powerful than official titles.
Right, because Stone was never the White House chief of staff.
Never.
But he didn't need to be. When you are the person who helped shape the principal's worldview before they even knew they were going to be a candidate, your influence is already baked into the foundation of everything they do.
It's foundational.
Even when things change formally. Because the records note that Stone officially left the Trump campaign in 2015.
The key word there is officially.
Right, because witnesses confirm he maintained constant contact with the people in the campaign's orbit.
The formal title vanished, but the network remained completely intact.
How does that work legally and practically?
Well, in the world of high-level political operatives, formally leaving a campaign is often just a strategic pivot.
A pivot to what?
It usually means shifting out of the official campaign structure and into an external vehicle, like a super PAC.
Okay, for anyone fuzzy on how that works, What exactly is a super PAC?
A super PAC is an independent political committee. It allows operatives to raise theoretically unlimited sums of money from corporations or wealthy individuals to run attack ads and push narratives.
But there's a catch, right?
Yes, as long as they don't legally coordinate directly with the official campaign.
Got it. So stepping away from the official campaign frees an operative from the legal, financial, and optical constraints of the candidate.
Exactly. It allows them to do the really aggressive strategic work from the outside with much deeper pockets.
So the architecture was drawn up in the 70s and 80s for a political movement that wouldn't fully materialize until 2016.
It's a long game.
And the overlap between the two men is not just theoretical. The dossier provides a literal side-by-side breakdown of this shared playbook.
It is a fascinating look at the mechanics of modern political warfare.
And it centers entirely on one core concept, right? Mm-hmm. Prioritizing emotion over policy.
That is the beating heart of the whole thing.
Let's walk through the architecture of this playbook, starting with a golden rule.
There is no bad publicity.
Okay, that sounds like a tired PR cliche from a 1950s ad agency.
It really does. But it was weaponized here in a way we've never seen.
How so?
Most conventional politicians live in absolute terror of a gaffe or a scandal.
Because a scandal means negative press, which means losing moderate voters.
Exactly. But in this playbook, a scandal is just free, wall-to-wall airtime.
It's an asset.
It is an opportunity to completely dominate the national conversation. If every news network in the country is talking about your outrageous statement or your latest controversy, they are mathematically unable to talk about your opponent's policy proposals.
You force yourself to become the center of the political universe.
You suck all the oxygen out of the room.
Which feeds directly into the next concept in the playbook.
Yeah.
The permanent campaign.
Right.
We are used to a certain rhythm in democracy. A candidate announces, they campaign for a year, there's an election, someone wins, and the campaigning stops and the governing begins.
That's the traditional model.
But the permanent campaign obliterates that rhythm entirely.
The mode of warfare never shuts down. Even after winning an election and taking the oath of office, the speeches, the rallies, and the entire media strategy remain explicitly focused on mobilizing the base against a perceived enemy.
Governing essentially becomes just an extension of the campaign trail.
You are always perpetually in attack mode.
And speaking of attack mode, that brings us to the next pillar. Attack is the best defense.
This is a massive departure from traditional political strategy.
Because usually, if a candidate is attacked on, say, their economic record, they put their defense secretary or their economic advisor on television to defend the record.
They bring out charts, they provide context, they try to win the logical argument.
Which is entirely defensive and honestly often makes you look weak and defensive.
Exactly. The strategy here dictates that when you are attacked, you never defend.
What do you do instead?
You pivot immediately and launch a vicious counterattack on an entirely unrelated, highly emotional issue.
Oh, so you just change the subject forcefully.
Yes. You throw the media and the opponent completely off balance. You force them to respond to your new attack, effectively making them abandon their original critique.
And you can only do that if you are willing to constantly feed the beast, which is the third pillar. Dominate the daily media.
In the modern era, attention is the single most valuable currency in existence.
Silence is losing.
Dominating the daily media means you have to create a constant, unending stream of content.
It's exhausting just thinking about it.
It is. A provocative social media post at 6 a.m., an outrageous statement at noon, a controversial personnel firing in the evening.
You construct a daily, inescapable soap opera that the press simply cannot afford to ignore.
It drowns out all other oxygen in the room. They have to cover you.
But the next step in the playbook is where it gets genuinely intense. It's the strategy to delegitimize opponents.
This is where things get really dark.
Because this isn't just a matter of saying, my opponent's tax plan will hurt the middle class. Yeah. It goes much, much deeper than that.
It is a fundamental shift in how you frame the opposition. You move away from arguing that the opponent is simply wrong on policy, and you begin aggressively pushing the narrative that the opponent is a criminal, a traitor, or fundamentally un-American.
If you successfully delegitimize an opponent, you don't have to engage in a debate with them.
Exactly. You don't have to counter their arguments. You merely have to defeat the existential threat they represent to the country.
It is a much more primal, aggressive, psychological trigger.
It bypasses logic entirely.
Which all culminates in the final, most crucial piece of the architecture, Polarization mobilizes.
The realization that you do not need to be a unifying figure to win.
You don't need 100% of the country, or even 60%, to like you.
You just need your specific side of the electorate to be significantly more angry, more terrified, and more intensely motivated than the other side.
Polarization is the strategic, intentional division of the electorate.
Yes.
I really want to dig into the mechanics of this with you. We keep circling this phrase, emotion over policy.
It's the core of it all.
From a strategic standpoint, why does an emotional attack work so much better than a solid, well-reasoned 50-page policy paper?
Well, it all comes down to human neurology. Processing policy requires significant cognitive effort.
Like brain power.
Exactly. If a politician stands at a podium and says, I have a detailed 12-point plan to reform healthcare by incrementally adjusting marginal tax rates and closing corporate loopholes, the listener has to stop what they're doing.
They have to actually think about it.
Right. They have to engage their prefrontal cortex, analyze the data, compare it to the current system, and project those effects into the future.
That takes time. It takes energy. And frankly, it feels like homework.
And nobody wants to do homework after working a 9-to-5 job.
No one.
But emotions, specifically primal emotions like fear, anger, or moral outrage, completely bypasses those logical processing centers.
It goes straight to the fight or flight response.
Straight to the amygdala. It triggers an evolutionary survival mechanism.
So if a politician stands at that same podium and says, that group of people over there wants to actively destroy your way of life, ruin your community, and take your home.
You don't need a white paper to process that.
No, you feel a massive surge of adrenaline.
You are instantly mobilized. Emotion travels exponentially faster. It goes incredibly viral on social media platforms that are, you know, specifically designed to optimize for outrage.
And it is vastly more effective at getting people off the couch and into a voting booth.
Anger is simply a much cheaper, much more reliable fuel source than hope or complex logic.
That perfectly explains the environment we live in today. But I do want to make sure we don't oversimplify history here.
That's important.
It would be really easy to say Stone is the sole puppet master. But this historical document introduces an important caveat.
What's that?
It notes that Trump had his own distinct political style and many other influential advisors over the years. So was Stone truly the architect? Or did he just hold up a mirror to a candidate who already had these instincts?
That is a vital nuance. It is historically inaccurate to label anyone the singular mastermind behind a phenomenon as massive as a modern presidency.
Right, there are too many moving parts.
The principal candidate had his own deeply ingrained instincts, forged over decades in the brutal, hyper-competitive world of New York tabloid media.
The Page Six culture.
Exactly. Instincts that naturally aligned with Stone's methods. However, what the historical record strongly supports is that the ideological DNA is an unmistakable match.
So they were on the same wavelength?
Entirely. Stone didn't invent the candidate's personality, but he provided a rigorous strategic framework. He offered decades of validation, and he provided the structured playbook that allowed a bombastic personality to be effectively weaponized for national presidential politics.
He built the theoretical foundation for the candidate's natural instincts. For you listening, the next time you open up a social media app and see a massive political controversy dominating the trending topics, you know, someone said something outrageous, one side is furious, the other side is cheering, the media is covering the anger nonstop, I want you to ask yourself a question.
A very important question.
How often is that controversy a genuine mistake, a clumsy gaffe? And how often is it a deliberate, meticulously executed strategy designed by someone following this exact playbook to monopolize your attention?
Once you understand the architecture of the trick, you start to realize that the chaos isn't an accident.
The chaos is the point.
Absolutely. But, you know, operating entirely in this gray area of permanent psychological warfare, where rules are viewed merely as obstacles to be bypassed,
yeah,
it inevitably puts you on a collision course with the institutions whose entire purpose is to enforce the rules.
Oh, absolutely. And that collision happened in spectacular fashion in the aftermath of the 2016 election.
It was unavoidable.
A massive legal wall appeared in the form of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation.
The transition from the campaign trail to a federal investigation is a brutal culture shock for a political operative.
I can imagine. According to the records, Stone became a central figure in this sprawling probe.
He was right in the crosshairs.
Investigators were looking into his contacts regarding WikiLeaks. They were examining his prior knowledge about the publication of hacked Democratic emails.
The Podesta emails.
Right. And most importantly, They were scrutinizing the sworn statements he made to the United States Congress regarding all of these activities.
Now, it's crucial to look closely at the actual indictment here, because the legal reality of what happened in that courtroom was vastly different from the fever-pitch narrative playing out on cable news at the time.
We have to be really impartial about this. The historical record makes a very sharp distinction. Special Counsel Mueller did not accuse Stone of conspiring with Russia.
Right.
There was no federal charge of treason and no charge of active, coordinated collusion with a foreign intelligence service to hack those emails.
That was the suspicion that fueled thousands of hours of news broadcasts, but it was not the reality of the legal indictment.
So what were the actual charges?
The collision happened over process crimes. In 2019, a federal jury found him guilty of 7 distinct federal crimes.
7?
Yes. These included obstruction of a congressional investigation, 5 separate counts of making false statements, lying to Congress, and witness tampering.
And what was the sentence?
The consequence was a sentence of 40 months in federal prison.
This clash is so fascinating to me. How does a career political operative, someone whose entire professional existence is predicated on manipulating truth, spinning narratives, and denying reality, survive when they are suddenly dragged into a federal courtroom?
They often don't. It is the ultimate clash of realities.
You have a man whose philosophy is deny, distract, counterattack, sitting in an environment where the rules of evidence are absolute and perjury is a felony.
It is the moment where public relations strategy fundamentally fails.
Because you can't spin a judge.
Exactly. On a campaign trail, if an investigative journalist asks an operative a highly uncomfortable question about their candidate, the operative can lie. They can pivot. They can attack the journalist's credibility.
There is no statutory legal penalty for political spin.
Right. But the moment you raise your right hand and swear an oath before a congressional oversight committee,
the game changes.
Drastically. Applying that exact same instinct, the instinct to obfuscate, to lay down smoke, to protect the principal at all costs, instantly transforms from a clever PR tactic into a federal crime.
It makes me think of getting pulled over on the highway.
Okay, I like your analogies today. Let's hear it.
Imagine a police officer pulls you over because they suspect you were doing 90 miles an hour in a 65 zone.
Okay.
But maybe the radar gun wasn't calibrated correctly, or they just can't definitively prove it in court. So you aren't actually going to get a speeding ticket.
You're in the clear on the speeding.
But when the officer walks up to your window and asks for your license, you panic.
Mm.
You lie about your name. You try to physically hide your driver's license under the floor mat.
Oh, wow.
You lean over and whisper to your passenger, telling them to lie to the officer, too.
So now you've just committed obstruction of justice and witness tampering.
Exactly. You successfully beat the original speeding ticket, but you are going to jail anyway because of the cover-up. The cover-up itself becomes the crime.
That is the perfect distillation of the legal peril operatives face. The initial underlying suspicion that there was an active conspiracy with a foreign power was not proven in court.
The speeding ticket.
Right. But the frantic actions taken to impede the investigation into that suspicion, the lying, the hiding of communications, the pressuring of other witnesses to align their stories.
Those actions were decisively proven.
Yes. The architecture of his public defense simply collapsed under the immense weight of federal legal scrutiny.
Which brings us to the climax of this legal drama, a moment that truly tested the limits of that 40-year mentorship we discussed earlier.
It was a very tense moment.
Stone was convicted. The appeals were exhausted. He was quite literally making preparations to report to a federal penitentiary to serve out his 40-month sentence.
His bags were practically packed.
And then at the absolute 11th hour, the President of the United States intervened.
It is a moment that perfectly encapsulates the entire phenomenon of this political era.
First, the President commuted his sentence, ensuring he wouldn't have to step foot in a prison cell, and shortly after, granted him a full, absolute presidential pardon.
A huge deal.
This event acts as a massive cultural Rorschach test for how you view the American justice system. The historical dossier outlines 2 starkly different perspectives on this pardon, and it's important we examine both to understand the depth of the polarization it caused.
We need to look at both sides objectively.
Let's look at the viewpoint of his allies and supporters first.
From the perspective of his supporters, this pardon was the long overdue correction of a massive systemic injustice.
Because they view the investigation itself as corrupt.
Right. In their view, the entire Mueller investigation was fundamentally flawed from inception. They saw it as a politically motivated witch hunt designed by a hostile establishment to cripple a duly elected populist presidency.
They view him as a victim of a deep state apparatus. And just to clarify that term for anyone who hears it thrown around when supporters use that phrase, they are referring to a belief that there is an entrenched, unelected network of career bureaucrats, intelligence officials, and legal professionals who actively collude to undermine political outsiders.
Exactly. To his supporters, he wasn't a criminal. He was a loyal soldier.
Taking a bullet for the team.
He was targeted by this biased institutional machinery, ruthlessly squeezed for information, and ultimately charged with technical process crimes simply because he refused to break and turn state's evidence against his friend, the president.
Therefore, the pardon wasn't an abuse of power. It was a righteous defensive act to protect a loyal ally from a corrupt system.
A complete exoneration in the eyes of his base.
Okay, now let's look at the other side of the ledger. How do the critics view this exact same event?
For critics, the pardon represents a profound and terrifying undermining of the foundational rule of law.
Because of what he was actually convicted of.
Their argument centers entirely on the specific nature of the crimes committed. He wasn't pardoned for some unrelated prior financial offense or a decades-old mistake.
He was pardoned for committing felonies, lying to Congress, obstructing an investigation, tampering with witnesses.
Felonies that were committed specifically to cover up facts regarding the very election that put the president into power.
So the argument is that the president used his ultimate unchecked executive authority to reward a man for obstructing an investigation into the president's own campaign.
Precisely. Critics view it as a terrifying precedent, signaling that if you are personally loyal to the executive leader, you are effectively immune to the consequences of the law.
It creates a system where loyalty supersedes legality.
It's a very dark view of the pardon.
The polarization is absolute. There is zero middle ground between those two realities. What is truly wild is how the pardon itself became the ultimate execution of his own playbook.
It is the masterpiece of his philosophy.
Explain that.
The pardon generated massive wall-to-wall media attention. It provoked intense, visceral emotion over what would otherwise be complex legal policy, and it deeply entrenched the divide between the two political bases.
For one side, it was a rallying cry of victory against the establishment. For the other, it was a mobilizing symbol of democratic decay.
It was a textbook Roger Stone event, with Roger Stone acting as the central character.
The man who orchestrated the spectacle became the climax of the spectacle.
Exactly.
But the story doesn't actually end with the pardon.
Yeah.
And this is where we have to bring in some incredible external documentation.
Yes, the documentary footage.
We mentioned earlier we were going to cover this. There is a Danish filmmaker, Christopher Gulbrandsen, who made a documentary called A Storm Foretold.
An incredible piece of historical evidence.
It really is. Gulbrandsen and his crew literally followed Stone for several years, capturing his actions in real time.
It gives us a primary source look at how he operates.
And what's wild is that this crew was with him during the immediate aftermath of the 2020 election, leading right up to the events of January 6th, 2021.
It's a very crucial timeline.
Again, remaining totally impartial here. The documentary shows Stone heavily involved in the rhetoric of the Stop the Steal movement.
Yes. The footage shows him organizing, communicating with various groups, and constantly pushing the narrative that the election was fraudulent.
He was in Washington, D.C. on January 5th and the morning of January 6th.
Surrounded by members of groups like the Oath Keepers, who were acting as his security detail.
Which is a striking visual on its own. Now, Stone himself did not go to the Capitol building on the 6th. He left D.C. as the riot was unfolding.
And he has vehemently denied any involvement in the violence or the storming of the Capitol.
But critics point to that documentary and argue that his years of pushing the emotion over policy playbook and his specific rhetoric in late 2020 helped build the exact powder keg that exploded that day.
It's the ultimate consequence of permanent political warfare.
Which forces us to step back from the specific timeline and look at the macro picture. As we review everything in this historical document and the documentary, we have to confront the ultimate question it poses about his legacy.
Is this operative, this architect, actually dangerous?
Evaluating the danger of a figure who has operated primarily in the shadows for half a century requires looking at multiple dimensions. The text provides a nuanced synthesis of his impact.
It's not a simple yes or no.
Let's break it down. First dimension, is he physically dangerous? The historical assessment says no. There is no evidence presented that he himself organizes, leads, or directs physical violence.
He is not a general marshaling armed troops in the streets.
His battlefield is entirely psychological. The warfare is narrative, not kinetic.
Second dimension. Is he politically influential?
The answer is a resounding, undeniable yes. Both his fiercest critics and his most devoted supporters universally acknowledge his exceptional skill.
You do not survive in the brutal ecosystem of Washington politics for 50 years, moving seamlessly from the era of Richard Nixon to the era of Donald Trump, unless you are incredibly ruthlessly effective at building networks and operating campaigns.
His influence on the mechanics of modern elections is indisputable.
And the third dimension, which strikes at the heart of his legacy, is he institutionally controversial?
Again, the answer is a massive yes. His federal criminal conviction for lying, obstruction, and witness tampering has permanently cemented his reputation.
Critics view him as a man entirely willing to stretch, bend, or outright break democratic norms for political gain.
While fans view him as an incredibly effective strategist who was martyred by the establishment precisely because he was so good at beating them.
But the most important conclusion the document draws is about his specific role in the ecosystem.
Right. It explicitly notes that he is not a policymaker.
He does not write legislation. He isn't sitting in a committee room drafting the intricate details of healthcare reform or negotiating international trade treaties.
So if he isn't writing the laws, what is his actual legacy?
His legacy is that of a framer, a master communicator, and a pioneer of political mobilization.
When you synthesize his entire 50-year career, you realize something profound about modern democracy.
Roger Stone didn't write the laws that govern us, but he wrote the modern playbook for how you win the power to write those laws.
He proved over 5 decades that you do not need the best policy if you possess the best polarization strategy.
Exactly.
Which leaves us with the ultimate takeaway from this deep dive. From the Nixon tattoo, to the international lobbying for despots, to the 40-year mentorship of Donald Trump, to the permanent campaign, the federal conviction, the presidential pardon, and his role leading up to January 6th. What is the final, lasting impact?
The true legacy is the permanent normalization of political warfare over political discourse.
It's just normal now.
He proved that treating politics as a relentless psychological blood sport is highly effective. And because it is effective, it has been universally adopted.
The combative architecture he spent his life designing is now the political building we all currently inhabit.
We're all just living in it.
Which leaves us with a deeply unsettling yet vital question to mull over. We've spent this time looking closely at the blueprints of the permanent campaign.
We've seen how it was built.
We see exactly how the philosophy that there is no bad publicity and politics is psychological warfare was incubated over decades and ultimately deployed on a national scale. My question to you, the listener, as you observe the political landscape today, is it even possible to go back?
That is the essential question for the future.
Once a generation of political operatives and candidates realizes that generating raw outrage secures more votes and more small-dollar donations than drafting nuanced policy, can a democracy ever return to polite, constructive discussion?
Or is this permanent campaign, this constant, exhausting state of political warfare, simply the new, irreversible reality of our system?
Can the architectural polarization be unbuilt? Or do we just have to learn how to survive inside this highly polarized house?
It is something I really want you to think about the next time you see a political controversy exploding across your screens.
Look past the noise. Look for the strings being pulled. Look for the architect.
Because once you understand how the trick is actually performed, you will never watch the political magic show the same way again.
I want to thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into Chapter 19 of the Trump dossier. It's been a fascinating, wild journey through the shadows of modern political history.
It really has.
But our exploration of this era is far from over. Next time, we are turning the page to Chapter 20, where we will examine the broader, lasting legacy of the Trump era between 2015 and 2029.
That's going to be a big one.
How did these specific dirty tricks and this deeply ingrained culture of permanent warfare permanently alter the political landscape of the Republican Party and the nation as a whole? It's a massive conversation, and you absolutely won't want to miss it.
It will provide the crucial context for everything we've unpacked today.
Until then, keep asking questions, keep looking past the facade, and always remember to question the narratives you see in the news. Thanks for joining the deep dive, and we'll see you next time.